Happy Monday. Hello. Welcome to Lunch Talk Live on NBCSN. I'm Mike Tirico. You think by this point, and this is the last week of the show, I think I'd be able to spit the name of the show outright. But we do have a mug. I don't know if anybody saw this. We actually got mugs. We'll deal with Chris Sims maybe later in the week. If you've missed any of these shows, including me complaining about not having a mug for the show, yeah, you can go back and catch our old episodes on podcast or YouTube, the YouTube at NBC Sports, our channel there. A lot of great interviews with so many people who have helped us understand from their perspective what's been going on in our country over the last couple of weeks, whether it's been COVID-19, return to sports, or everything that has happened around the protest in the country. And we're going to continue those conversations, blend them in with the return of sports as well here today. Our guest list includes Dawn Staley in just a moment or two. Tremendous perspective from one of the best coaches in all of sports. Chris Collinsworth, our analyst on Sunday Night Football. Eddie Olczyk will talk about the return of hockey and horse racing, a big race this past weekend, and we are less than 2 weeks away from what will be the biggest event in the return to sports to date. That'll be the Belmont Stakes. Also, Pat Forty, so much is going on in college sports. And Lee Diffie, who was on site calling a sporting event, which is rare to say these days. He was in Texas for the IndyCar race on NBC on Saturday night, won by Scott Dixon, and Diff will join us in a little bit. Some of the stories from this weekend include how powerful and how poignant the protests have been, including NASCAR, as they raced in Atlanta this week. All the cars came to a stop and listened to a message from NASCAR leadership about their reaction to dealing with the race issue in America, George Floyd, the protests, and everything else. Very powerful. In addition to the images of all these athletes who joined in protest, peaceful protest that went on around the country, some of the biggest names in sports lending their support, lending their passion, lending their presence, and also lending their stories to help America understand the context through which we have to see each other and the future. And right in the vein of all of that, Dawn Staley joins us, head basketball coach at South Carolina. Her team was the number one team in college basketball, was going to be the number one overall seed in all likelihood in the NCAA tournament. When everything came to an end, Dawn Staley has won multiple gold medals. She is player of the year, coach of the year. Nobody can say that in the history of the Naismith Award, that they're the coach of the year, the player of the year, Hall of Famer as a coach and a player and a person. And she joins us here for her perspective. Dawn, there's so much to unpack here. I want to start with the very moving essay that you contributed via the Players Tribune this week that in some ways tells your story, as we've heard a lot of stories over the last month or so. Can you share just the headlines of your journey that has given you the perspective on race that you're able to add to the conversation?
Well, I think most people don't know. One of the reasons why I took the job at South Carolina was because of my parents, who were both born here in this state. And also a lot of people don't know why my mother left the state. And I did share that in the Players Tribune because I just think it's appropriate. I don't think I've shared it any other place besides there. My mother, you know, who was sent to the store by her mother, wanted her to get some meat. And the butcher, you know, went to the back to get some meat versus, you know, the meat that my mother pointed out in the refrigerator that you can see. And my mother didn't want to take that meat home from the back. So she wanted the meat that was in the refrigerator. And everybody knows my mother. She's a headstrong woman. She's deceased now, but she was known for her strength, for her discipline. And she was a cook, so she understood, you know, exactly what she wanted. And, you know, she said she wasn't taking that meat back to her mom, and the store owner showed her out the store and told her never come back to his store. And that's a small town. I mean, my mom's from Swansea, South Carolina. So once he was instructed her not to come back to his store, my grandmother knew she needed to put a plan in action. And that is to get my mother out of the state of South Carolina and up north. And she ended up in Philadelphia, where she had her five kids. And I mean, I don't know if we lived happily ever after, but she put us in a place where we really felt safe. So, you know, when my mother got older, I thought it would be a great idea to bring her back to South Carolina with her siblings, and which was a great thing. And I think I got the best of both worlds when it comes to, you know, some high power league, like the SEC, and then personally bringing my mother back. But that wasn't at the forefront of my mind when I took the job. So that's one story. You know, the other stories, you know, that came behind the Players Tribune letter is, you know, what I witnessed with my eyes. And that's George Floyd taking his last breath and losing his life. And I've never seen it. I grew up in a project in North Philly. I've never seen anyone die. I never seen anyone take their last breath in that manner. So that was moving. That moved my heart. It was conveyed in my heart to just, you know, put pen to paper and share it with, you know, anybody that would listen through the Players Tribune.
And thank you for sharing that. For those of us who didn't know the story or your perspective, who know your career as a great player and your time as a Temple head coach and now at South Carolina and USA Basketball as well, it frames your story in a different way with a lot more great life ahead for you. Dawn, there's been a lot of listening, and this was listening in many ways, reading your story. But this has to evolve at some point, weeks, months, I don't know what that point is, to doing and to action. So from your seat as a head coach of a lot of young women who are very talented in basketball, also a very strong voice, both white and black, what is the level of doing that's next for those of us in sports that we can help make the next generation a better and more peaceful place to live and coexist?
Well, Mike, here's what I like what's happening. We're having hard conversations, and everybody that raises their voice for Black Lives Matter movement or not, they're being called on it. I mean, whatever side you choose, you're being called on it, whether the masses like it or not. That's one. We do have to have these hard conversations. I've had plenty of conversations with, you know, some of, you know, my white friends who did not know. And I honestly feel like they really didn't understand until something like this came about. So we had hard conversations about what it is, and they will never know to see through a Black person's eyes, to have the perspective of a Black person, to hear about their perspective. We see race. I see race. You know, I see when I'm going to a restaurant and I'm the only Black person, you know, that gives me pause, but it doesn't stop me from going. I feel like voting is a big thing in our world today. There are people, young people, I think anytime there's any great movement of any kind, it was done by young people. And I feel like young people are starting to align themselves with lawmakers who feel like they feel and who can historically voted in the favor of some of the things that they feel are in the forefront of their lives, their young lives today. I want to give our players a voice, whatever voice that is. My thing is voting. They don't have to get behind that. They have to get behind what they're passionate about. And I'm eager to see what they come up with because we have weekly Zoom meetings, which is tomorrow. I'm eager to see what they want to get behind for some long-term resolution. And I think young people need to start using their voices, but also, you know, I know where I am as well. I represent the University of South Carolina. I represent a state that historically has had a long history of racial issues. And I have to make sure that our players know whatever voice they decide to use, they're going to piss some people off that, you know, don't align with their views. So they must be passionate. They must be educated. They must be articulate in knowing that when someone says a response to their voice, that they have, you know, they're armed with knowing how to navigate through conversation that may not, you know, be favorable to what they believe in.
In our remaining 3 minutes or so, I want to hit a couple of other topics with you. Those Zoom calls that have taken on a different tone with your team over the last couple of weeks, that had to be so difficult before any of this happened, when you had a team that was on its way to being a favorite to win, if not the favorite to win the women's national championship, and then the season gets essentially stopped in place, not to resume. How did your players deal with that absolute just punch in the gut to know that the season's over and we'll never know if we were the best team in the country like most people thought we were?
You know, our players are incredibly resilient. And this was by far the best experience that I've had coaching a team full of players who are of great character. They got great parents. They just held each other accountable from day one until the very last day. So all of their surprise and anger was geared towards knowing that our seniors would not be able to see this thing through. They knew they would have an opportunity in the future to play in another, hopefully play in another NCAA tournament. But they're just truly upset that the seniors didn't get a chance to finish off their careers, but they're super happy that they got a chance to be drafted in the WNBA with the sixth and seventh pick. So to our seniors, there's some consolation with them being able to play out and live out their dreams. So they're extremely happy for them.
And this was almost going to be the spring and summer of Dawn Staley in women's basketball, a favorite in the college and the team that is on this generation winning streak in women's basketball in terms of the Olympics that Dawn was part of as a player. How about your thoughts regarding the Tokyo Olympics pushed back a year and the players, because you were at a transition point with some of the veteran players on this team. What does that Team USA world look like to you right now as we think about 2021?
Well, I'm happy that they pushed it back a year rather than canceling it altogether. You know, everything is still so fluid. You know, we just received an email from Carol Callen last week, just kind of giving us a penciled schedule. There's nothing that we can do at this point because nothing's really set in stone. But we do want to hold some training camps leading up to the Olympic Games. When they'll be, we don't know, but we know that hopefully we'll get back to some normalcy where we can get those things in concrete and continue our quest to training for a seventh straight gold medal.
Dawn Staley's been a big part of building USA basketball, as you saw with the results on the graphic there. She's built amazing teams in Columbia, South Carolina. Dawn, good luck next year with the basketball, with your team, as you try to put the pieces together and continue to grow as a society. And the Dawn Staley Foundation works with At Youth Risk as well. We should mention that if you want to check out some of the good things that Dawn's been a part of, not related to basketball score. Hopefully we'll get to talk in about a year and a couple of months in Tokyo after a seventh gold medal. We appreciate the time. Stay safe.
Thank you. You too, Mike.
American basketball royalty right there, Dawn Staley. When we come back, the National Football League very much in the news over the last couple of days and also getting back to play as well. Chris Collinsworth joins me after this.
It has been a difficult time for our country, in particular, Black people in our country. First, my condolences to the families of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and all the families who have endured police brutality. We, the National Football League, condemn racism and the systematic oppression of Black people. We, the National Football League, admit we were wrong for not listening to NFL players earlier and encourage all to speak out and peacefully protest. We, the National Football League, believe Black lives matter. I personally protest with you and want to be part of the much needed change in this country.
Powerful video on Friday night around 6:30 Eastern time. Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, in direct response to that video with many players, including MVP of the league, Patrick Mahomes, Michael Thomas of the Saints, significantly involved in getting the players together to do their video that was put out 24 hours before. The league response certainly had a lot of conversation over the weekend, bringing our friend Chris Collinsworth, Sunday Night Football analyst, of course. Chris, that is a departure from the responses to protests that we saw back some 3-4 years ago with the league, and pretty powerful when you sit back and you watch the commissioner saying those words.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's, quite frankly, something we've all been waiting to hear a little bit. It's amazing how far we've come in those 3 or 4 years, you know, that and how prescient the whole thing with Colin Kaepernick taking a knee was to the events, you know, that happened with George Floyd. So it's such a unique time. But if you believe in the greatness of this country, you also believe that this is opportunity, right? That this is a chance to do some of the good stuff that we saw during the civil rights movement, that we saw during the Vietnam War protests, where I think everybody would agree in retrospect that all of that was historically correct. And I think that these protests are going to be historically correct as well, and that we're going to see some real positive change.
And it's interesting, Chris, because I was visiting with someone from the league this weekend, and they reminded me that the league had already donated $42 million to racial injustice causes and all the types like that, and has pledged another $20 million. The words, though, by the leader of the National Football League, and then we'll see what the subsequent steps are with the owners of the teams, that adds a different weight to it. It almost adds a togetherness from the players and the owners. They're never going to get to the perfect connection on a lot of their issues, but this is one that if the league takes head on like this, it could put the players and the voices of players in this day in a very different framework.
And I think the words "we were wrong" is something we don't often hear out of the National Football League. Those are pretty powerful words in and of themselves. So that's exciting. I think the conversation is going to be so different. I think that as we look back at the anthem protests and all the different things that happened, I can remember thinking, this is a lot of work, right? And I can remember Al and I and you and Fred Gedeli, and we were trying to figure out, all right, how are we going to cover this thing? What are we going to say? We've got half the players in the locker room. Some of them want to be taking a knee. Some of them want to be doing speaking out. Some want to stand up. Some want to put their hand on the guy's shoulder. Some want to do all these things. But in reality, I think the greatness of this country comes from you can take a knee during the national anthem. And you can protest peacefully, and you can try to make this country better. And if that's what the commissioner is saying, then I think that it's going to be a really exciting year. I'm looking forward to what we can do in a positive direction.
Yeah, we saw what happened with Drew Brees, his apology. His wife put something out on Instagram, Britney's statement as well. This weekend, the president has been involved. Brees goes back to the president. So there's a lot of the conversation that's going to continue and certainly will inflame opinions on both sides. But I think the tenor to hear these conversations in the country is a little different. There's more understanding than there was 3 or 4 years ago. Can you just take me back, Chris, to your days in locker rooms, your days as a Florida Gator, your days as a Cincinnati Bengal? The race issue in some ways felt like it was handled well in the locker room and in that space. What have you observed as time has gone on, how that conversation has maybe expanded or maybe not adjusted enough over time?
You know, I think the exciting part of what happened was that we were all excited about growth in social issues related to race, right? We were sort of, boy, this is a lot better today than what it was when I played or the generation before or whatever. And yet the George Floyd murder, I don't know how else to say it, the Ahmaud Arbery, the Breonna Taylor, all these different things, like threw it in our face in a way that I don't know that it's ever been thrown in the face of this nation before. And this generation of young people stood up and said, incremental change is no longer good enough. It's not good enough. we're going to put a stake in the ground right here. This is it. This is the time. We are fixing this. It's not enough to get better. It's time to fix this. And I found myself all week in the last 2 weeks being so proud of what these young people have done, and frankly, a little embarrassed that I didn't do it, that my generation wasn't the generation that stood up and said no more. Said no more. This isn't any more incremental stuff is good enough for us. This is no more. And that's what's going to make this protest and this movement historically correct. And I hope this is it. I hope this is it, because you think of what this country could be. I mean, if we could fix this alone, forget all the other issues of the country. If we could fix this alone, what untapped potential does this country have? I mean, it could just be unbelievable. And I look forward to it. I really do. I think there's going to be some real positive change.
I agree. We saw some video there of a protest. The Broncos put that video on their social media feed. Their players were out. Larry Fitzgerald penned a very perspective-filled column for the New York Times with his thoughts. And that got me thinking, Chris, when you, Al, me, all of us, Michelle Tafoya, we all go to these facilities and talk to the NFL players. It's a league that's two-thirds African-American. And you said, how many times have you spoken to Larry Fitzgerald? These are true leaders and true voices who are using their leadership in a locker room, their leadership with bringing along a young receiver or a young quarterback. They're using all those skills in a very different way now. And whether it's a different level of braveness, a different level of comfort, they're wading into places where you didn't want athletes to wade into with a lot more comfort. And a lot of us are paying attention to their voices because what we've seen Larry Fitzgerald do on the football field has given his name value so much. And I give a lot of credit to those players who are feeling more comfortable to speak what's on their minds now, where maybe they didn't 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, Mike. And I think the key word was listen. And I'm old enough now that I've listened a lot. One of my roommates with the Bengals was a guy named Joe Kelly. And Joe used to tell me that he would get pulled over 3 or 4 times in L.A. driving to his house every week. And I said, what? And he said, yeah, he said, I had a gold Mercedes and drive into my neighborhood and the cops would pull me over. And I'd never heard anything like that. I mean, I was getting mad, you know, having a conversation. And he was like, oh, it's no big deal. They just pull you over. And I said, yeah, I live down here. And I go, Joe, it's a big deal. What do you mean it's no big deal? I've had conversations with Arthur Ashe. I've had conversations with Tony Dungy. Tony Dungy, you know, I said, Tony, this was before he became a head coach. I said, why is it that you're not a head coach in the National Football League? And I don't know if Tony will remember this answer or not, but he said, because all the owners have ever seen are white men holding up the Lombardi trophy at the end of the year. And I think that to some extent it has an impact. And I can remember being in Miami that night when Tony won the trophy and held it up and sort of having this little wave of emotion come over me that the guy who had told me that story was also the guy that broke that trend.
And Tony's words have been so educational for so many of us here. He's been terrific with us as a guest over the last couple of weeks. And it all happens, and it's all part of the circle of life. And you experienced a couple ends of the circle of life in your own world this weekend. And I want to first start with the sad note. And I want to remember Ken Riley, player who you played with, fifth all-time in the league in interceptions, who passed away this weekend. What can you share with the folks who didn't see Kenny Riley play that made him such a special figure?
65 interceptions, fifth all time in league history. He belongs in the Hall of Fame. Let me tell you about this guy though, Mike. He was, when at practice, I went against him my rookie year when he was probably 15 years in the league, and he beat me every time. He just embarrassed me out there. He just was all over me. But as soon as the play was over, he would walk me back to the sideline and tell me what I did wrong or what tip he got or exactly how he saw what I was going to do. He taught me more football that year than I learned from any other human being in my whole life. And then come Thanksgiving, when they send all the rookies out on that wild goose chase, where they send you to the to the turkey farm to go pick up the turkeys, right? That whole thing. Just right. Before I got in my car to drive off and go get everybody's turkey at this farm that didn't exist, he said, "Hey, there's no farm. Just go home. Just go home." I mean, this guy was a Rhodes Scholar candidate. He was a quarterback. He played defensive back. He was just one of those guys that, and he never, ever did anything self-serving in his life. One day I hope that he's in that Hall of Fame.
What a story. What a story. A great player, too. I mentioned the circle of life. Could you lose somebody who was impactful to you? And the Collinsworth family grows on the weekend. One of the best texts I've received in a month was the great news for you and your beautiful wife, Holly. Grandparents, again, even though you look so darn young, congratulations on another grandchild.
Unbelievable, Mike. She had the baby at home. The other grandfather and I were on the golf course playing. Let me tell you, I left Katie at like 9:30 in the morning to go play golf. As we're walking off the last hole, we get a phone call from Pat, my son-in-law, Bumpy's son. And he said, congratulations. And I was like, what? Are you guys going to the hospital now? Or is she going into labor? Nope, she's already been delivered. And we delivered her at home. It's like, what? What? And they made the decision like 3 weeks ago that they were going to do a home birth and COVID-19 and not go to the hospital. So literally from leaving her at 9 o'clock in the morning to when I walk off at 1 o'clock, that was it. I had my grandson in the world and whatever. I mean, it's like I'm just trying to keep up with everybody else in the world right now. This is the craziest time of my life. Gosh. I'm just telling you.
Well, we know that you will give all the golf lessons to that grandson because Grandpa was on the golf course when you came in. So you were going to get the golf lessons from the pro himself. So congratulations to everybody. We give you guys.
You know better than to think I'm giving golf lessons to anybody. You, more than anybody, understand that.
Just wanted to throw that out there. At least there's an excuse for it. Give everybody big hugs from the Tirico family. Congratulations. Thanks for your perspective, too. I love listening to you talk about life. You have such a great perspective on it. We appreciate you. Thanks, Chris. We'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Good seeing you, pal.
All right, Chris Collinsworth there. When we come back, here on Lunch Talk Live, Eddie Olczyk will join us. We'll talk, what we always do with Edzo, hockey and horses, right after this. Well, this will be Stanley Cup final week on NBCSN. Remember, it's Stanley Cup final, not finals. Don't make that mistake, folks. The 09 Cup final, which was the reprise of Red Wings Penguins. You'll see Game 2 at 5:30 Eastern, Game 6 at 7 Eastern, Game 7 at 9 Eastern, and the championship film after that. It was a couple of great back-to-back finals. Get to enjoy the work of our man, Eddie Olczyk. As he and Doc Emmer called that, Edzo joins us here now. And Eddie O, it's starting to look more and more like we will see the Stanley Cup raised at some point in September, October, who knows, but the phasing of hockey's return continues with that next phase of groups of no more than six starting to allowed to be happening. So what is the conversation you've been hearing about the potential walk down this road to get hockey back here sometime this summer?
Well, Mike, it's always great to see you, and thanks for having me. You know, you're just teasing that 09 Cup final, and you know that very well, living in that area of Detroit. Don't forget, the one interesting sidebar with that final was Marian Hossa, right? Hossa was on the losing side of back-to-back Stanley Cup finals, right? Pittsburgh loses, Detroit loses, and then he leaves, and he goes to Chicago for the third straight year, which is absolutely unbelievable, Mike, where he could be on three different teams in three straight years and be in the Stanley Cup final. The third time was a charm for Marian Hossa, one of the greatest players right. we've had in the NHL for the last little while. But just a little sidebar there when people are tuning in the Stanley Cup week here on NBCSN. But to the heart of your question, Mike, I think just talking to a lot of people involved in the National Hockey League as far as players, coaches, ownership, everybody is obviously very excited, but knowing that, you know, we're still very early in this process of you know, the COVID-19 and the pandemic and, you know, getting through these small little workout groups that, you know, teams and players are allowed to have. And some are just staying put. A lot of players are just staying in areas where they probably feel a little bit more comfortable instead of maybe traveling right now. But again, it's the first step of what, maybe 15 or 20 until hopefully we can see some teams getting back together sometime in the middle of July or late July. And then hopefully we can drop the puck for real. And we've got a format, Mike, as we talked a couple of weeks ago. So there's a lot of excitement for sure in the people that I've talked to here over the course of the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, just the headlines on the phases. Phase three, which would be the opening of training camp, not before July 10. Doesn't mean it's going to be necessarily on July 10, but hopefully if things work out in many of these cities that way, that's the case. And then we've all talked about a few weeks of training camp and maybe August to start to see some action. We don't know the cities yet, too. We'll have to see how that plays out. Edzo, if you were a player at this point, and a lot of guys, I talked to a couple of players actually the last week or so who have not been on skates or are just getting back on skates, how would you approach trying to think about, all right, maybe July 10 as a window to start a training camp, given where you've been the last 3 months?
Well, this is really foreign territory, Mike. And as you know, most of our players, when I say our players, the players that play in the National Hockey League, I mean, they don't, very rarely they take this much time off, even after a long grind of a Stanley Cup final. Think about it, right? Usually the Stanley Cup final is over sometime in the middle of June, and guys will be back on the ice or just playing pickup hockey probably towards the end of July, early August. So players do not go 3+ months without putting on their skates. Now, I know there have been some players that have been so-called skating in the dark wherever they are living just to get out there, feel the puck a little bit, get on the skates. But as you know, Mike, there's nothing like being in hockey shape. And that's the biggest thing I think most players have talked about is, you know, I could be in great shape and training and running and biking and on the elliptical and everything else. But, you know, you go out there for the first time on skates, you're going to raise your hand to the teacher and go, no, honestly, I really did work out. I really did exercise right. when we had all this time out, but you have to get out there. So, you know, I think if players can get on the ice themselves, Mike, for a good 3 to 4 weeks, you know, whether it's 3 days a week, whatever it is, and then they could get back. I think most coaches and players I've talked to feel like they could have maybe a 2-week camp. Now, if that's 14 days, obviously you're going to have to give those players some time off, as well as how many players are going to be allowed to be coming back, Mike, with these teams as far as a roster size. That's another thing that they're still trying to figure out. So getting right. on the ice is the most important thing. Skating around and just, you know, going at a certain rate, that'll help. But there'll be nothing like getting back with your teammates for a couple of weeks, and then you jump right into it. And whether you're playing the play-in or you're one of the teams that have the byes on either side, the top four teams, you got to get up to speed very, very quickly. There is no Cliff Notes version for what we are going to hopefully see here in the next couple of months.
And just to remind everyone, 1 through 4 in each conference will play a round robin, one game against each other to determine seeding, 1 through 4. 5 through 12 matched up to play in best-of-5 series. The winners of those will advance. Then we'll get the winners of these 8 series to join those other 8 top 4 in each conference. We'll have 16 teams. And then, Edzo, we'll have best-of-7 series now. We do know that. We're also going to see reseeding when it comes to that, which, Eddie O, people have talked about for a long time. It will be interesting to finally see it in place for those next couple of rounds, the first round traditionally and then the second round, to see the best left taking on the worst left.
Yeah, and you know, I think that that's right. And Mike, we talked a couple of weeks ago when the commissioner came out and made the announcement about the return to play format and what have you. I think the league has done an amazing job, not only the commissioner, Mr. Bettman, but Bill Daly, the Board of Governors, the Return to Play Committee, Players Association. I think that they got it right here. Now, you could argue, and again, you can poke holes at the format and whatever, but at the end of the day, I think that you certainly want to reward the teams at the top that had the best so-called regular, well, the regular season that we did have that came to the conclusion, to be able to go, okay, get your business done in those play in those games that you're going to play for seeding, and then go ahead and then you get your invitation to the team that, you know, the lowest seed. So top team, if it's Boston, then they go ahead and get whoever is the lowest seed. So I like how that they've decided on that. But again, still very early in the process of a lot of hurdles still to jump over here, but it's fun to talk about the possibilities and the matchups. And, you know, look at, I mean, that Carolina New York series, Mike, the Hurricanes and Rangers. I mean, that's a dynamite series. Blackhawks and Oilers. I mean, not a lot of defense there. So we better sharpen up our pencils and have some extra sheets on the scorecard, because there's got a chance to have some games that are 7-6, you know, 6-5 type of games when you have stars like, obviously, Patrick Kane, Leon Draisaitl, Connor McDavid, Artemi Panarin. You can go on and on. So two series that are play-ins that are going to be, hopefully we get to that point, will be very entertaining because of the offensive ability and the skating on both teams.
All right, hockey stick down, racing form in hand. Let's talk about Santa Anita this past weekend. Usually a derby prep, and it's one that you look at and say, okay, the horse that comes out of there usually is one of the ones in the top of the conversation for the Kentucky Derby. Obviously, the whole schedule is moved around, but what did you think of the performance of Honor AP winning the Santa Anita Derby on Saturday?
Well, I was very happy because I picked him to beat Charlatan for the nice exacta here for a $2 investment. He got back $10. So hopefully people made a little bit of, made a little wager there and made a little bit of money. Honor AP with Mike Smith up, John Sheriff's the trainer. The race set up perfectly well for Honor AP. And I think this is a horse that can run all day. This race was a mile and an eighth at Santa Anita in Arcadia, California. Of course, the Kentucky Derby is a mile and a quarter. I think it hits Honor AP right between the eyes, Mike. And I think this is a horse that certainly people will have to take notice of. Now, that race set up extremely well for Honor AP. You had a couple of horses go out there on the lead. Charlatan was maybe a little bit wide, got caught into the speed duel, and then it just set up perfectly for Honor AP. But, Mike, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I think what we're on the verge of seeing is that you're going to have some horses that are going to be able to mature, to grow at their own speed. You're not going to be forcing them. And obviously, we've passed the first Saturday in May. We're going to the first Saturday in September. You're going to have horses that are maybe starting to grow a little bit, you know, learn the game a little bit. You have trainers able to take their time. And maybe a horse like Honor AP wouldn't have been ready for the first Saturday in May, but he will be ready for the first Saturday in September. And, of course, we got the Belmont coming up in 12 days on NBC, which is going to be great. Looking forward to working with you and our team. And but I thought it was an outstanding performance by Honor AP.
And horse racing's back. You can bet the races at home. Visit americasbestracing.net to do that. And we only have 30 seconds left, but Tis the Law is the horse name that you will hear the most between now, Edzo, and the Belmont Stakes in a dozen days.
Well, another horse that is very tactical, isn't too far out of it, but can certainly press the pace. And a horse that has done nothing wrong for Barkley Tag, the trainer. And I think we're sitting on an opportunity here, Mike, where you have the opportunity where we could have an unbelievable Kentucky Derby once we get through the first jewel of the Triple Crown, the Belmont, in 12 days. You can make a case. I can make a case right now for five or six horses, but certainly Tis the Law. I think if you ran the Derby tomorrow, Kentucky Derby, if you ran the Kentucky Derby tomorrow, I probably would think that Tis the Law would be the favorite if the race was tomorrow. But keeping these horses safe and healthy, Mike, is a big challenge waiting for the first Saturday in September.
It's just a very different setup. Any plans that you've used in the past are out the window, the way the prep races are on the schedule now. But Tis the Law, which might be the best of the three-year-old crop, will be in the Belmont. So we'll get a first look at that in a dozen days. Edzo, I'll talk to you between now and then. Thanks, buddy.
Great to see you, pal. Thanks for having me.
All right, Eddie Olczyk there. When we come back here on Lunch Talk Live, Pat Forty, one of the best writers in the country, going to join us. Always has his finger on the pulse of college football and college sports. And, man, there's a lot going on there. Pat coming up after this. There are always a ton of moving pieces in intercollegiate athletics, and never more so than right now. Is that the case? It's a great chance to bring in a longtime terrific person covering the sport and friend now working for SI.com. Pat Forte joins us for a few minutes of some perspective. And Pat, I want to start with the topic that has been front and center the last couple of weeks, I should say. And those are the protests after the death of George Floyd and others. And college football coaches, I think, have found themselves in a very interesting lane here where they have been, in essence, quiet early on. But now, as they've become more vocal, sometimes that opens them up to criticism. This is an interesting lane to find for the college football coaches in dealing with their players first and then their messaging as a university overall.
It sure is, Mike. I mean, you know, as a whole, college football coaches are pretty cautious individuals, not really ones to jump out on a social issue limb, per se. But I think the times have somewhat demanded it, given the racial backgrounds of the players that they work with and the ages that they work with and the fact that football coaches like to present themselves as molders of young men. Well, this is a life-molding situation for young people and for older people, really, in the United States right now. So I think they have been put in positions some of them aren't that comfortable with, and we can see it and we can tell. And then some are more comfortable with it. But I think it's important that, you know, given who they are and their stature on campus and who they work with, that they get out and make their voices and their feelings heard, and hopefully their sincere and legitimate voices and feelings.
And Pat, it's a changing time in every walk of life for people finding a voice. And I think of all the stories and anecdotes of the last few days, Marvin Wilson, the captain for Florida State football, he struck me the most because he really spoke up and said, no, our coach has not been doing what he said he's been doing necessarily in terms of dealing with us and this issue. And I don't know if you get a college football captain to have a voice like that 10, 15 years ago, yet he spoke up and was pretty honest about it and got Florida State to respond in kind here.
Absolutely. That was very significant because it wasn't a former player. It's not somebody in the NFL with money and clout. This is a guy that's on the team right now. As you said, a respected member of the team captain, and he called out Mike Norvell. And there's one thing that I think if you are a coach in this day and age, you can't fake it with your players or with the public about who you say right. You are versus who you really are. You better be pretty authentic. You better be in touch with your locker room. You better be in touch with what's going on with those guys and be able to present an honest portrayal of who you are and what's happening. Because otherwise, players are not afraid and shouldn't be afraid to speak up and say, no, this is how it really is at our school.
And think about the Iowa situation, Pat. We always talk about how the strength and conditioning coach is usually the most important hire for a head coach because that strength and conditioning coach spends all the time that football coaches aren't allowed to be with the players and is around them and has a great little pulse of the entire team. And Iowa's coach, Kirk Ferentz, had to make a very significant move with Chris Doyle, who's been a long time, as well compensated strength and conditioning coach as there is out there because of past players and some of the things they said regarding their treatment. That's something that may not have happened if the environment hadn't changed so significantly.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're talking about a guy who's been at Iowa as long as Kirk Ferentz has been there. And Kirk Ferentz is the longest tenured head football coach in the country, so 22 years. And he had given a lot of authority and a lot of trust to Chris Doyle, and now that has been absolutely called on the carpet by a lot of players, and it's something that they have to address, I think, in a really forthright manner. And here's the thing, you know, you look at Kirk Ferentz is one of the most respected guys in college football, and for a lot of good reasons. Mm-hmm. So he's been an overachieving coach. He's put a lot of guys in the NFL at a place that doesn't necessarily have that natural recruiting ground and everything. But you wonder if too much of the same, of status quo there, is worked against Iowa to a degree. Too many of the same guys doing the same things in the same jobs for too long, and you lose touch with your locker room. You lose touch with where the younger generation may be. Kirk Ferentz's son is on the coaching staff. Norm Parker, the defensive coordinator, his son is on the coaching staff. Most of the support staff is overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly people that came up through the Iowa system. That's not to say it's all bad. But sometimes outside ideas, outside voices can be really important to get a fresh look at yourself, self-scout, so to speak, your program culture, and maybe say, hey, we need to do some things differently.
Last thing, I want to hit the COVID-19 impact on intercollegiate athletics. We're seeing reports of teams coming back, a couple of players testing positive. So the screening, if you will, is starting to work, these things that are put in place. But this is going to be a very long summer and fall, not just for college football, all college sports, all higher education, period. Pat, what are you hearing about the internal conversations on, yes, we'll have a football season, or I'm not really sure if we're going to have a football season just yet?
Boy, everybody is still right now full speed ahead to a football season of some sort. We are going to play, I believe, but you know, how many fans in the stands, we don't know. And this is going to be very much an incremental process, Mike, where what we know on June 7th is good, but what we know on July 1st and July 7th is going to matter a lot more than what we know today. Because things keep changing. You know, the virus changes. We're seeing right now surges in case numbers in Florida, Texas, California, the three most populous states in the United States. Surging case numbers doesn't necessarily mean surging deaths, but it could. Surging hospitalizations certainly would be a concern. And if you're sitting there as the president of a university and saying, boy, there's more and more cases of these things happening, Memorial weekend, people got out and about. There have been a lot of street protests all over the country. People have been out and about in close proximity. What kind of effect is that going to have on our demographics and our numbers from a health standpoint going forward? I think we'll, by the 1st of July, we'll see if there's been a big spike corresponding to that. And I think that will influence what universities are able to do in terms of bringing back students and in terms of keeping football players and other athletes on campus and keeping things going toward a Labor Day weekend start. So still a lot of moving parts out there, but I think the confidence is there. But with new data coming in this next few weeks, I think it's going to be really important and will influence what happens.
And Pat knows it's not just college football. Pat's a parent of a terrific student athlete in one of the Olympic sports. So there's a huge domino effect for what happens with football for the other sports. I got to squeeze this in and just have limited time. The FBI investigation into college basketball, they got a bunch of headlines, has now had an NCAA impact with a significant hit on Oklahoma State, years probation, multiple scholarships lost down the line. Do you think this is the beginning of a set of significant things we're going to see the NCAA do regarding that FBI investigation?
I think it could happen. Yeah. That was pretty significant for a school that some people forgot had even been charged because of all the other ones. And because this will look like a relatively minor case for Oklahoma State to get a 1-year postseason ban. If you're one of the 11 other schools that have been involved in this, you're sitting there saying, uh-oh, what about us? Because the NCAA now has been applying a very simple but strict matrix for penalties. And basically, if you've got a level one violation charge against you, you are subject to a postseason ban, possibly multiple years. Right. So there's a lot of other schools that watch that and I think probably came away a little bit nervous about what's going to happen with their case.
Ton of information. Nobody better to unpack it for us than Pat Forty, SI.com. Pat, good to catch up. Stay safe. We'll talk soon.
Thank you, Mike. Good to see you.
Yeah, same here. When we come back, if you're wondering what it's like to go back to work, our Lee Diffie did just that at Texas Motor Speedway calling the IndyCar race. He's with us after this.
Throughout the week, there were a lot of conversations that took place that I've never experienced within our sport, from drivers to drivers, drivers to NASCAR, and overall, everyone wanted to take a stand and do something.
That's from NASCAR America, Jimmy Johnson, and that's a little bit of what Bubba Wallace told us might happen during the week, and in fact did. So you'll hear that interview with Jimmy, plus an interview with Kevin Harvick, who got the win in NASCAR on Sunday. That's on NASCAR America coming up on NBC, and NBCSports.com will have that whenever it's convenient for you. Saturday night, hope you were with us in prime time on the big network as IndyCar finally dropped the green flag. It'd been a long time. It hadn't raced really since last fall. It was a pretty exciting race as well, won by Scott Dixon, kind of like Harvick, the guy who wins all the time. Was first under the checkered flag Saturday night, continuing an unbelievable streak of consecutive years with a victory in the series. Lee Diffie was there in person for us to call it, and Lee joins us now. Lee, let me start with just the experience for you, and this is more I'm curious, in our business as a peer, what was it like to call an event with nobody there?
Bizarre, Mike. Bizarre. I'd never experienced it in my career, no matter what the sport, because we, as you know, as a broadcaster and as a fellow play-by-play, we feed off the crowd. Now, in motorsport, to a lesser degree, but yeah, when we're certainly on an oval, when we're at the top of the grandstand and you can kind of look out over the crowd, it felt really odd. And, you know, as weird as it felt for us, we were impacted minimally. For the drivers, when they got out of their cars or they walk out onto pit lane to get into their cars and they look up and there's nobody there, it was pretty surreal for them.
What was the overall reaction to how the planning ended up in practice and actually happening on the entire day that included practice, qualifying, and the race itself all in one day?
I think it went really well. I think IndyCar did a terrific job. It was certainly a whirlwind of a day because some crews, a lot of people from, you know, from the headquarters in Indianapolis actually got the charter in the early hours of the morning, like I think it was 5 o'clock on Saturday morning, flew to Texas, got to the track, did their day's work, you know, practice session, qualifying session, and nearly a 300-mile race, packed up and then flew back to Indy and got back to Indy post-midnight in the early hours of the morning. So it was something like a 22-hour day for many, many people. But IndyCar did a great job. There wasn't a moment where we didn't feel unsafe. We had to pass certain medical checkpoints, screening checkpoints going into the track. Flying was definitely interesting. It was actually quite pleasant, Mike. It was, the plane was very clean. There was lots of space. You know, the irony is that there's probably never been a safer time to fly, right? The whole logistical process of it was all quite easy. You know, for you and I who basically live on planes and in hotels and rental cars, and we know what that slog is like, it was actually quite refreshing.
It's good to hear. Makes the trip easier. Lee's gone out and he's survived it. Scott Dixon won the race, Lee. And to your point, as he was just getting ready to take the checker, you brought it up. What an incredible streak of consistency and excellence from Scott Dixon. Year after year is one thing, but to win year after year for over a decade and a half is remarkable in any sport, especially this one.
This guy is incredible. He is 39 years old, so not yet 40, does not look his age and certainly doesn't perform as somebody approaching 40. He seems ageless, to be honest. And he sets himself an extremely high bar, puts a lot of pressure on himself. But he's one of those athletes where we see in football or basketball, baseball, whatever it might be, he just continues to produce. And age is only a number. And Scott Dixon personifies that. He's going to go down. He already is. He already is one of the greats of IndyCar racing. And he's living in rarefied air where he's almost touching numbers but only AJ Foyt and Mario Andretti racked up. So that indicates, you know, for some of the viewers on the show today who aren't necessarily IndyCar fans, that helps you understand where Scott Dixon is. He's living in very rarefied air.
I forget if you said it or Townsend Bell said it, our analyst with Paul Tracy. It's like the Tom Brady of the sport. Now, here he is at 39. He's still elite in the game, and he's a consistent winner. It's a great, great analogy. Let's wrap up with this, Lee. So IndyCar has a July 4th weekend date with NASCAR, both at the Brickyard. How significant could that be for IndyCar? IndyCar will not be doing the 500 in the Oval. It'll be more of the road course. But how significant could that be for Indy?
Well, I think it's terrific. I mean, especially when you think about the new owner of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the series, Roger Penske, one of the world's most successful businessmen. It's been a childhood dream of his achieved to own the Speedway. And for the first time ever to have NASCAR and IndyCar at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for the first time to share the weekend billing is huge. IndyCar already did something that it's never done on NBC, being in prime time on Saturday night. And the ratings were really encouraging, I'm pleased to say. And then now, I know there's a little bit of a lull for a few weeks, but when we return to racing with the series at Indy, to share it with NASCAR, to be at the Brickyard, 4th of July weekend, how more American and more pleasing and uplifting for the fans can that be?
Yeah, and the note I got from research was the presence of Lee Diffie on the primetime show, huge boost to the ratings. So I think that's exactly what you sent
that
me to say.
Tanking.
I'll
that
talk to
tanking.
You, Diff. I'll talk to you, buddy. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike.
Great job on Saturday night. Lee Diffie, our friend, a terrific job with IndyCar and all the stuff that he calls. Brian Kelly, the coach of Notre Dame, with us tomorrow. Peter King with Rich Eisen starting right now. Have a great Monday.